This week, there was a monumental event which took place, which was reported about in the papers throughout Eretz Yisrael. Israel offered a belated apology to the Beatles in the United Kingdom. After a delay of 43 years, the State of Israel officially apologized this past Sunday to the Beatles, or the remaining Beatles, Ringo Starr, Paul McCartney, for retracting an invitation to perform in the Jewish state in 1965. Israel's ambassador to Great Britain went and met with the half-sister of John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, and he apologized for their oversight in having canceled their invitation to perform in 1965 in Eretz Israel. And I quote you as to what the ambassador said: "We are happy to invite you to perform in Israel's independence celebrations and to fix a historical mistake from 1965, which prevented Israeli audiences from seeing a band which influenced a whole generation." Various explanations were given for canceling the invitation back in 1965. A popular notion was that the then manager of the education ministry feared that the audience would damage Heichal HaTarbut, the prestigious Tel Aviv Hall which had just been inaugurated in Tel Aviv. And I thought to myself, why exactly was this considered a monumental event? And at first I said to myself, well, the reason why is rather obvious. This might very well mark one of the first times, or one of the few times in Israeli history, certainly modern Israeli history, where an Israeli actually stepped forward and apologized, admitting that they were wrong. This itself deserved recognition. But then I thought to myself, the real reason why this was such a momentous occasion is because of its revelation. Here we sit in the same week, as of tomorrow, when the Winograd Committee will be releasing its report with regards to our present Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, in terms of his responsibility or lack of it thereof, in terms of his connection and his plans or lack of them thereof, in the Second Lebanon War, in which so many soldiers died, in which so many fatalities occurred, in which there was such disarray and so much threat upon the population of Eretz Israel, in which the security of Israel was compromised, and in which there was a tremendous amount of weakness that was revealed, not only with regards to the government of Eretz Israel, the army, the IDF, the defense ministries of Eretz Israel, that has always historically been so strong. Why is it that the government takes such measures to apologize for what seems to be a historical mistake of 1965? Because they canceled the Beatles' arrival in Israel. And yet we are adorned with a Prime Minister who knows that he does not enjoy, by any stretch of the imagination, popular votes, who knows that he has made grave errors in judgment, mistakes that have probably caused the deaths of so many people, that have caused our nation to perish and to be under such great threat over the last few years. And yet he cannot step forward and apologize for what would appear to be a grander historical mistake of 2008, of 2007. That does not happen. Why is this? Where does this come from? While we subscribe wholeheartedly to last week's Parsha of Parshat Yitro, the awesome impact as we all stand up and testify and bear witness to what Klal Yisrael witnessed to so many generations ago, Aseret HaDibrot, Kolot Ubarakim Yotzim Min Ahar, or the fanfare, the theatrics, the nisim v'nifla'ot of HaKadosh Baruch Hu kivyachol b'chvodo u'b'atzmo, where Klal Yisrael witnessed the hand, the mightiness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And yet, in reality, when we think about it, the parsha of Mishpatim is far more impactful. Why? Because the parsha of Mishpatim is pivotal. It is focal with regards to our roles to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yitro reveals the fanfare of the Aseret HaDibrot. It sets the stage. Parshat Mishpatim demands that the players take the stage. It demands practicality. Now that the Torah has been given to us, what do we do with it now? How do we ascribe and embrace it practically to our lives at this present moment and for the generations to come? That is a question that Parshat Yitro does not necessarily answer, and that the Torah immediately follows in Parshat Mishpatim in an attempt to give us clear guidance and direction how to practically interpret the Aseret HaDibrot into our own lives. In fact, it is not until Parshat Mishpatim that Am Yisrael declare Na'aseh V'Nishma. Parshat Yitro, Klal Yisrael say Na'aseh, but they do not say Na'aseh V'Nishma until everything is laid clearly, practically in front of them in Parshat Mishpatim. If this is so, one wonders, why does the Torah in Parshat Mishpatim open with the one mitzvah, the parsha of Eved Ivri, of a Jew who becomes a slave, who works for another Jew, who is freed in Shnat HaShemitah, the seventh year of the cycle of the Jubilee? Why is it that the Torah opens with this mitzvah? If we're talking about practicality, if we're talking about guidance, and how to use the mitzvot on a daily basis, surely I could think of other mitzvot that are more appropriate to reveal that role rather than the mitzvah of, or the laws of Eved Ivri, of this indentured servant. The Ramban, Nachmanides, explains as follows. Hitchil ha-mishpat harishon be-Eved Ivri. The Torah starts with this particular mitzvah, מבני שיש בשילוח העבד בשנה השביעית. Because on the seventh year, when we send the Eved, the servant, away, when we release him and give him his freedom, there is Zecher ליציאת מצרים הנזכר בדיבור הראשון. We are reminded of the first commandment, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim. I am the Lord your God, who what? Who freed you from Egypt, who released you from your slavery and your enslavement. And here we do the same as what Kiviyachol HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for us. We free our slave. We give our servant. We don him with his freedom. That in itself reminds us of Yetziat Mitzrayim, the history of where it all began. Kemo she'amar v'zacharta ki eved hayita be'eretz Mitzrayim. The Ramban goes on to explain that not only are we reminded of Zecher liYetziat Mitzrayim by freeing the Eved Ivri, but we are also reminded even of Zecher lema'aseh bereshit, the 7 days of creation, by which on Shabbat we too, in a sense, free ourselves from the world. We liberate ourselves. We feel liberated. We feel at ease, reflective. We have the moment of Shabbat. And therefore, Eved Ivri is where it all begins. But I think that if we go and move towards a greater analysis of what the Ramban is really telling us, we will realize the impact, the great introspect, that the Ramban wants us to appreciate beyond his simple context, or what would appear to be the simple context of the words that he expresses. Rav Shlomo Aviner explains that an Eved, a servant, is someone who is constrained and he is constricted. A servant is someone who is not free to explore and to investigate. He does not have his own time. He does not have his own opinion. He does not have freedom of choice. And therefore the Eved is not an individualist, but rather he is someone who has to subscribe to popular opinion. An Eved, a servant, is someone who does not necessarily live by the motto of righteousness, but his life is dictated by policy of peer pressure and of perception, because he is not free to think as an individual. My dear friends, Rabotai, this is a problem that is alive and well, both in the Jewish community and in Eretz Yisrael at large. It reveals itself first and foremost in the government that we have. Avodim, slaves to foreign powers, slaves to public perception, and ultimately slaves to an ego-appealing existence that does not, or certainly does not, strive to reveal truth and to reveal sincerity. And this is not where it ends. It pains me to no end that this concept of being avadim reveals itself particularly in the area of education, and particularly in Eretz Yisrael. Israel has always followed a system of education based on quantitative results. It has always followed a system in which success is dictated based on how much information I have learned, how many hours have been invested. When we look back to the strike that the teachers had a few months ago, the entire solution was based on quantity. Let's add an hour, and we're willing to add a little bit of a salary, rather than talking about the quality of education. What is the best way to teach? What is the most creative way to incorporate and therefore give feedback towards concepts and towards allowing our children, our future generations, to learn how to think, how to understand, how to investigate, and in reality, how to be free, how not to be avadim to the world around them. We have consistently been avadim to a progressive and a product-oriented world, a world that does not promote ideology, but rather promotes productivity. The students of today, and I talk to my students in the Yeshivot Hezder who are post-high school, pre-university, and the feedback that they classically give me is they say, Rabbi, we are not taught in school how to think, but rather what to learn. It's an educational system that is defeatist and that is avdut, based on enslavement. You look at the educational system that exists in Eretz Yisrael today, and you take a child, a student, who might not fit a particular mold that Israel or that the educational system designed itself for. A child who might think or might be out of the box. And all of a sudden the classic answer that the Israeli educator has is, let's give the child evaluations, let's give him testing, let's put him in front of a vad, in front of a board to evaluate how we should deal with this child. Let's give the child medication. As opposed to an analysis by the teachers of how they can better deal with creative methods, creative teaching, expansive methodology. That's avdut. That's being an eved, a slave to a system. rather than being someone who is free, who is liberated, who is able to expand one's mind and one's imagination. And certainly someone such as our children and students, who should be freely taught how to live a life based on personal introspect, personal query, and investigation. I remember I had an encounter with the principal of my children's school in Eretz Yisrael, an Israeli fellow, never left the country. And I looked at the school, and you see, it's quite clear. There's a large Anglo-Saxon community who send their children to the school. You look around the school, and clearly it lacks in discipline. It's what we call in Israel, to a large extent, a balagan. You come to an auditorium for a presentation, the kids are running around, the teachers don't have full control, they don't walk through the halls quietly, there are always kids pitter-pattering throughout the hallways, and it's a balagan. So I went to the principal and I said, listen, in America it so happens that they have various methods of discipline, of curriculum, they inculcate different ideas of how they could instill order and discipline both in the classroom and outside around the schoolyard, etc. Why don't you let us put together some funding? We'll send you to the United States. You'll go spend a week there. You'll visit different schools, different Jewish schools. Maybe they'll give you new innovative ideas of how to learn about disciplining children other than the classic punishment, of how to deal with positive feedback and positive sense. I said to him, let's send you. So his response was, and I was absolutely flabbergasted. He said to me, I should go to the United States to learn from them how to educate? They should be coming here to learn from me how to educate properly. And I said to myself, he too is an eved to a system, an eved to habit, and an eved to an ego. The story of the Prime Minister who was willing to apologize to the Beatles, but not to his own people, is the same story of a principal who was not willing to apologize to his students, and who was certainly not willing to learn and to adapt to change. Last night I was on the phone with a rabbi in the United States. He happened to be a conservative rabbi, and I was amazed. I won't say which city he was from, a very popular Jewish populated city. So he told me that normally in his synagogue, he doesn't have a mechitza. And about a month ago, he celebrated his son's bar mitzvah, and he himself feels that the mechitza is the right way to behave in a shul. Obviously, there was nothing he could do about it, being a conservative rabbi, and classically in conservative temples and synagogues, there is no mechitza. But for his son's bar mitzvah, he and his family felt strongly that there should be a mechitza to demonstrate to their child what is the proper behavior. At least for one Shabbat, for his bar mitzvah, that's the way it should be. And he put up a mechitza in his temple, in his synagogue. And he told me that 95%, 300 families from his synagogue walked out and never showed up again. Amazing thing. And I said to him, well, what are you going to do about Parnassah? What are you going to do about, you still hold the position and title, but you don't have a congregation? And he says to me, Hashem Yazor, God will help, God will provide. I said to myself, Kol HaKavod. I don't know if I agree with him, I certainly don't agree with him, with regards to his theology, with regards to his decision-making in terms of halacha. But I can tell you that if I had to pick a rabbi, I'd want someone who could stand on his principles like that. Someone who is not an eved. Someone who is not enslaved by his board. Someone who is not enslaved by popular policy or by the people around him. Someone who could say, Hashem Yazor, and free, willing to subscribe and appreciate where the ultimate service should be. Kadosh Baruch Hu helps those who help themselves. And those who help themselves are only those who are free to do so. It is only when we recognize this principle that the basic foundations of Jewish civilization, from education to halacha to government policy, can be properly recited, properly decided, and ultimately can have the great effect of causing us to be a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. Shabbat Shalom.